This week on Our World, President Obama eases stem cell research rules. We talk with an expert, enjoying the health benefits of green tea, and a place in Texas where historic windmills meet a sustainable energy future.
We see the wind blow a lot around here, and it's a shame to see it just blowing dust, so might as well do something with it.
Might as well. Those stories, an update on the Space Shuttle, a Women's History Month website of the week, and more. I'm Art Chimes. Welcome to VOA Science and Technology Magazine, Our World. This week, U.S. President Barack Obama signed an executive order overturning restrictions on federal government funding of embryonic stem cell research. The restrictions had been imposed by then-President Bush in 2001. They limited government-supported research to existing stem cell lines. Mr. Bush cited ethical reasons for his actions. Viable human embryos would have to be destroyed. And in a televised statement, he described embryonic stem cell research as the leading edge of a series of moral hazards, which could include human cloning. That was President Bush. In a statement at the White House on Monday, President Obama agreed that human cloning is profoundly wrong, but said that embryonic stem cell research could have tremendous benefits.
Scientists believe these tiny cells may have the potential to help us understand and possibly cure some of our most devastating diseases and conditions, to regenerate a severed spinal cord and lift someone from a wheelchair, to spur insulin production and spare a child from a lifetime of needles, to treat Parkinson's, cancer, heart disease, and others that affect millions of Americans and the people who love them.
To learn more about stem cells, we spoke with Dr. Leonard Zahn, who heads the stem cell program at Boston's Children's Hospital. He also teaches at Harvard Medical School. He begins by explaining what a stem cell is.
A stem cell, in general, is a cell that can reproduce itself and also have the ability to turn into a tissue type. And in your body, you have organs, and inside the organs, most of the cells participate in a function. But there is often a very small population of cells that actually have the ability to remake the organ.
Well, those are adult stem cells you're talking about. What about embryonic stem cells?
Sure. So embryonic stem cells come from embryos. And these cells have the ability to make all the tissue types of your body. So in a culture dish, they remain undifferentiated. But if you pull them out of the dish and put them under certain conditions, they will start making organs. And so I can turn them into heart. I can turn them into nerve cells. What we don't know exactly is how to make the population of cells that would go into a patient directly to fix a particular disease. So I think that there's still a lot of science to do with regard to making these cells turn into tissues that would be transplantable, that would actually rescue a diseased organ.
The opponents of stem cell research on embryonic stem cells pointed to the advantages of adult stem cells. How much credence do we give those assertions?
Well, I think if you look at the largest body of scientists in the world, the International Society for Stem Cell Research, about half of the scientists work on embryonic stem cells and about half work on adult stem cells. So what that tells you is the scientific and medical communities value both sources.
Well, what sort of therapies are likely to first emerge? What diseases, what conditions are the most promising targets for stem cell therapy?
Well, when we think about stem cells, what you're trying to really do is repair a particular disease. And the diseases that we think will fall first are the ones in which a single cell is responsible for that particular disease. So, for instance, immune system diseases where a single blood stem cell is responsible might be one of the first that would be treated with embryonic stem cells. I think diabetes is a disease where the insulin-producing cells are missing. And then finally, I think a disease like Parkinson's in the brain, where a single type of neuron that makes a chemical dopamine is missing, and if you could put in cells that would make dopamine, that might help the disease.
So moving forward, what are the major research challenges in the years ahead?
Well, I think there's a couple different challenges. One of them is to actually be able to turn the cells into the type of cell that would be transplantable and then would last for the lifetime of the patient. And then a second thing that I think has to be done is to invent new ways of creating embryonic stem cells that would match the immune system with the patient. Now, there's some new exciting technology which makes use of taking a skin biopsy and trick it into thinking it's an embryonic stem cell.
And if you do that, obviously you would not have the potential rejection problems.
That's exactly right.
Well, after the action by President Obama this week, lifting some of the previous restrictions on stem cell research, how does that actually affect the, I don't know, can we call it the business of science, how the science is done around the country?
It's very clear that the field has been held up by presidential policy. And so the lifting of those regulations allows the science to move faster.
Dr. Leonard Zahn is the former president and founder of the International Society of Stem Cell Researchers. And researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology say they've created a new kind of battery that can be recharged in seconds rather than hours. Think about charging your mobile phone. It takes a long time. That's because getting electricity in and out of a lithium-ion battery is slowed down in part by a material inside the battery called lithium iron phosphate. The MIT scientists found that by giving the material a special coating, it dramatically speeds up movement of electrical energy in the form of lithium ions within the battery. VOA's Jessica Berman picks up the story.
The problem, they say, is that the ions are sometimes blocked on the surface of the material as they try to get into the openings of tiny tunnels they travel through. By creating a new surface structure, the researchers say they fixed the problem. The result is a battery that can be fully charged in about 20 to 30 seconds, compared to traditional lithium batteries, which can take a number of hours, according to co-inventor Hirt Seder.
And at that point, I think it becomes a bit of a lifestyle modifier. If you're talking about, say, personal electronics devices, you know, typically now we charge these overnight, you know, because we don't want to sit around for an hour or two.
Seder says the trade-off is that because the batteries discharge their energy quickly as well, they require more frequent recharging. But he says they do not degrade as much as regular lithium batteries with repeated charging. MIT researchers are now working on a way to make rapid recharge batteries that hold their energy longer. Seder says it's up to battery makers to decide when to start producing them.
If they wanted to, they could fairly quickly insert this into existing cells, into existing battery cells. The material has been licensed already to a maker of material, so a large supplier to the battery industry. If they scale it up, battery makers could start testing it in large cell and commercialize it.
Seder predicts the rapid recharge batteries could be available to consumers in 2 to 3 years to power a wide variety of products like cell phones. A study describing the development of high-speed lithium batteries is published this week in the journal Nature. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And it's time again for our website of the week, when we showcase interesting and innovative online destinations. March is Women's History Month here in the United States, and to mark the occasion, we feature a website that introduces you to notable women who have made their mark on more than 3,000 years of human history at Britannica.com/women.
The Britannica Guide to Women's History is a website that profiles 300 women who changed the world.
Kathleen Kuiper is a senior editor at Encyclopedia Britannica. Britannica, despite the name, is based in Chicago, and the roster of notable women is heavy with European and American choices, from pop singer Madonna to dancer Isadora Duncan to astronaut Sally Ride to physicist Marie Curie. But it also includes many who are likely less familiar to most Britannica readers in the West.
We have the Egyptian singer Umm Kulthum. We have Cleopatra, Asia Jaber, the writer, Fatima Alkansa, the poet, pre-Muslim poet, Koken, Kerry Takanawa, of course, from Oceania, Tsung Mei Ling, Indira Gandhi, Ding Ling, and others.
Making your way around the site is easy. The women are grouped on a very useful timeline and by region and activity, scholars, athletes, activists, and so on. Kathleen Kuiper says each woman is profiled in a biography with pictures and sometimes examples of their own writings, what scholars call primary sources.
We think it's important to hear a woman in her own words. It's important to hear how she addresses a topic, how she writes about it. Is she dramatic? Is she simple? Is she straightforward? Is she eloquent? All these things you can tell by actually reading the words that a woman wrote.
There are also video clips and other multimedia features, plus learning activities for students and more at Britannica.com/women, or get the link to this and more than 200 other websites of the week from our site, voanews.com/ourworld. You're tuned to VOA's science and technology magazine, Our World. I'm Art Chimes in Washington. Green tea has long been a staple in Asian countries. As the beverage has become more widespread in the United States and elsewhere, so too have studies that report its health benefits for everything from weight reduction to prevention of cancer and cardiovascular disease. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, new research finds that green tea may also promote healthier gums.
The fancy coffee machine in Kenneth Corman's office also makes green tea.
And I understand from the people in our office that order supplies that actually the green tea is very popular in the office.
Green tea gets a good review in the Journal of Periodontology, which Corman edits. He says the March issue includes a study which analyzed a number of lifestyle factors for 940 middle-aged Japanese men, including toothbrushing, smoking, and green tea consumption.
And what they determined is that the green tea intake was a significant protective factor in terms of severity of periodontitis in every parameter that they measured. So bleeding was less, so the overall inflammation was less.
Periodontitis is a chronic inflammatory disease that affects the gums and bones supporting the teeth. It's caused by bacteria in the mouth and is made worse by poor oral hygiene. Cornman says the presence of a chemical compound in green tea called catechin may explain why it lessens the disease's impact.
And that particular chemical, when purified and studied in the laboratory, has extensive ability to reduce inflammation throughout the body and also the ability to inhibit the growth of certain bacteria which may be involved in diseases like gum disease.
Corman says the study underscores the connection between healthy gums and a healthy body. He says chronic inflammatory conditions like gum disease, heart disease, and Alzheimer's are interrelated.
Because each one of these chronic inflammatory diseases does tax your body in terms of the overall inflammatory burden and load that your body's trying to deal with.
That could be reason enough to start drinking green tea, although Corman points out that it's no substitute for good oral hygiene and regular visits to the dentist. I'm Roseanne Skirbel.
Well, this is the place in the program where we plan to have the sound of the space shuttle Discovery blasting off from Cape Canaveral, Florida. But NASA officials called off the scheduled Wednesday launch because of an equipment malfunction. VOA correspondent Brian Wagner has been following developments. Brian, what was the problem that prompted the delay?
Well, they were filling the liquid hydrogen into the external fuel tanks, and they discovered that there was a leak, and they figured that the hydrogen was just leaking into the atmosphere, and they figured at launch time, if there was enough hydrogen in the area, it could spark, ignite, cause a very big problem, to say the least. So they aborted, they drained the tanks, and they are now looking at what the problem could really be. At this point, they figure it's something wrong with the plumbing on the launch pad that would be relatively easy to fix. So that's what they're looking at now.
So the shuttle now is set to launch sometime, well, Sunday evening at the earliest is what they're saying.
Right. It looks like Sunday. They say maybe even Monday. And if that doesn't work out, then they'll probably have to scrub the entire mission because, you know, at this point, they're kind of running out of time because they've got another mission, a Russian mission. The Soyuz is set to launch on March 26th. So, you know, they can't have both crafts at the space station at the same time. So if they don't get the shuttle off the ground by Monday, it's likely that they'll scrub the entire mission, postpone until April or something like that. And, you know, that kind of affects all the dominoes down the line. You know, one problem here can affect things going forward.
So this is a construction job. What do they have planned?
There are two big things that they need to deliver to the space station. There's one big set of solar arrays that will really boost power generation on the station. And they also have the final truss segment, you know, these big trusses that form the backbone where all of the other components of the space station kind of hang off. It's pretty critical to, you know, getting the other modules and everything delivered and installed.
The first space shuttle flight was April 1981, so almost 28 years ago. Mm-hmm. So the end of the shuttle program now is in view.
Yeah, this shuttle gets off the ground. There's, we believe, eight more. Of course, that's somewhat up in the air. People talk about, you know, whether the new president might have more missions, fewer missions, or just keep it at the eight. But you're right. I mean, this mission would deliver the final two major components to the space station. You know, kind of running out of equipment to fly up and install on the station. The end is in sight. You know, the question obviously becomes how long will the station indeed run? The new administration has yet to kind of say where they stand on the issue and what would happen with the space station once it's completed. We're reaching kind of the transition point in the NASA program.
Okay, VOA correspondent Brian Wagner, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The three astronauts on the International Space Station, meanwhile, had to take shelter on Thursday as a piece of an old rocket motor whizzed past. NASA officials say the chance of a collision was small, but as a precaution, they had the two Americans and one Russian take shelter in the Soyuz vehicle, which is docked at the space station. Usually the crew nudges the space station out of the way when space debris is detected, but this time they were asleep and didn't have time, so they ducked into Soyuz for 6 minutes until the danger passed. And finally today, one of the key sources of renewable energy being developed today is wind power. Large turbines can generate electricity most efficiently in windy places like the Great Plains, the flat midsection of the country that stretches north from Texas into Canada. Wind power is nothing new in this region, where windmills have long played an important role in pumping water and in milling grain. VOA's Greg Flakus reports from Lubbock, Texas, where the American Wind Power Center and Museum tells the story of wind energy's past and future.
Windmills were once seen on almost every farm and ranch in the American heartland. The expansion of electrical service and the use of electric pumps brought an end to the windmill era. But visitors can still see dozens of these classic devices at the Wind Power Center. About 90 windmills of various sizes and types are maintained inside the museum's massive building in Lubbock on the Texas Panhandle. Executive Director Coy Harris says machines that harvest wind power make a lot of sense in this part of West Texas.
We see the wind blow a lot around here, and it's a shame to see it just blowing dust, so might as well do something with it.
The Wind Power Center obtains most of its operating power from a wind turbine atop a 50-meter-tall tower in its windmill park. On good windy days, the turbine often produces more electricity than the center needs, so the excess is sold to the local power company. On days when the turbine is not producing enough power, the center draws electricity from the local grid. Since wind is intermittent, Coy Harris says cities and towns cannot rely on wind exclusively.
They're going to have coal-fired plants and everything else because people still want to have electricity even when the wind's not blowing.
American Wind Power Center Development Director Glenn Patton says wind-generated electricity has great potential, but it's partly limited by out-of-date infrastructure.
The problem is we have a grid system in certain areas that goes back to the 40s and 50s and 60s. And that grid system cannot handle the power of a wind turbine.
But wind farms are being successfully operated in many parts of West Texas, including a cotton processing plant near Lubbock. There are also plans to develop wind farms on the Gulf of Mexico coast, another windy area not far from major urban zones like Houston and San Antonio.
The places where you do see wind farms, either they're in a good wind area and have access to a major grid system, or you will actually start seeing some wind turbines that actually will power or provide power to a particular manufacturing plant.
But plans are underway here in Texas and elsewhere to connect wind farms in windy zones to grids in faraway cities where demand is high. T. Boone Pickens, who made billions of dollars in the oil and gas industry, is investing in a large wind farm to be built in the Texas Panhandle. Pickens estimates that more than 20% of the electrical power used in the United States in coming years could be produced by wind power. His goal is to connect his turbines in West Texas to the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area grid. But at least part of his plan has been sidetracked by the recent drop in oil and gas prices that make wind power less economical. One of the big drawbacks of wind power is that its output cannot be regulated the way a plant fired by natural gas or coal can. Researchers are looking for effective ways to store excess energy for later use.
As the wind died down or whatever, it would just open and close all day long.
Glenn Patton says inventors more than a century ago developed efficient windmills using basic but elegant mechanisms. He says such innovation today may make wind power more viable as part of a basket of renewable sources of energy to power the American future. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Lubbock, Texas.
And that's our show for this week. If you'd like to get in touch, maybe you've got a science question we can answer on the show, our email address is ourworld@voanews.com, or use the postal address, Our World, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Rob Sivek is our editor, Bob Doty is the technical director, and this is Art Chimes inviting you to join us online at voanews.com/ourworld, or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science and technology in our world.